Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts. WSECU's goal is to help make the right card make a difference. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
My name is Andy Morton. Back in 2013, I tried to sell my wife on the idea of me flyboarding. That's the thing where you're out on the water and two fire hoses shoot out from under your feet and put you up in the air like Iron Man. She told me I would break my neck. Well, too late. I'd already bought the Groupon. Best $100 I'd ever spent.
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and recently we asked some friends to tell us about something that they spent money on that wasn't strictly necessary, but totally worth it.
Hi, my name's Bridget Lehman. My husband and I recently got married, and we don't even like cake. So we realized that what we should focus our budget on is having an open bar. And needless to say, the dance floor was hopping all night long.
My name's Jen Matthews. So last year, I spent money on fifth row end zone Seahawks tickets. As everyone in Seattle knows, unless you're a season ticket holder, Seahawks tickets are super expensive. But I have to tell you, there's nothing like the experience of being so close to the field that you can make eye contact with a player after they score a touchdown. Worth every penny. Would totally do it again. Go Hawks!
Hey, my name is Greta. I bought a yoga sweatshirt dress because I'm really investing in nice loungewear. And it's worth it because there's nothing better than lying around in something called a yoga sweatshirt dress.
Hi, my name is Kelly Sir. My junior year of high school, I wrote an incredibly large check to the super cute guy running the tanning salon because he convinced me that if he could just sell one more tanning membership, he would earn a trip to Hawaii. Despite the fact that I was subsequently burned badly in the tanning bed and actually never went back to use the membership, it still seemed like money sort of well spent because I helped out a cute guy. Typical me.
Okay, not totally sold that that last one was really worth it, but who am I to judge? Today on Sound Effect, it's stories of money well spent on education, on reparations, on unconditional love. That's coming up on Sound Effect from KNKX. Hi, Gabriel Spitzer here, and you're listening to Sound Effect. Today our theme is money well spent. There's a guy named Ajit George in Factoria, Washington. Ajit spends part of the year in India, where he oversees a school for a very particular group of kids. They're the poor children of India's untouchable caste.
They're the lowest of the low, and they're the ones that are the street cleaners and the garbage pickers and latrine workers. You know, they're considered that something about them, maybe even in previous life or by some reason or the other, has made them unworthy and polluted.
Children born into this life would probably be stuck in a cycle of poverty if not for this school, which began operating 22 years ago. It's a boarding school called Shanti Bhavan. Now, starting a school like this takes a lot of money. The funding for Shanti Bhavan came from Ajit George saying no thank you to a very large inheritance. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing has more.
Before we get to that inheritance, and it was really big, we make a quick stop in India. In a large courtyard in southeast India, Abraham George, Ajit's father, and the founder of Shanti Bhavan, talks to a room full of parents who are entrusting their precious 4- and 5-year-olds to this multi-year program.
We are here to bring up your children, to look after them.
Each new class has about 26 students, and they stay here through high school. Families only get to see their kids 2 or 3 times a year. Abraham tells the parents exactly what he needs from them.
All you have to do is to let them know you love them and encourage them. Nothing else. Everything else we will take care of, because we want to produce children who will completely change your families.
These clips come from a 4-part documentary on Netflix that was made about Shanti Bhavan. It's called Daughters of Destiny. Abraham George was born and raised in India. He's from a middle-class family, and when he was in the Indian Army, he traveled around the country and was exposed to levels of poverty and suffering that he hadn't seen before. He made a promise to himself to do something about this. This desire to help stayed with Abraham when he moved to the United States. Here, he built a successful career in finance and with his wife raised two boys in New Jersey. Ajit George is Abraham's oldest son. Today, Ajit's home base is in Factoria, Washington. He moved here because his wife got a job in tech. Growing up back in Jersey, Ajit was able to track the upward trajectory of his family's wealth by where they lived. First, there was the small apartment in Montclair.
Back when Montclair was not so gentrified as it is today. Stephen Colbert was not living in Montclair then.
His dad started to make more money. Next, the family bought a house in North Caldwell, New Jersey, the suburb where the fictional character Tony Soprano lived.
I did not see any mobsters in North Caldwell, but it was definitely nicer than Montclair.
Finally, Ajit's father had a mansion built that could be mistaken for the White House.
And it was kind of ridiculous. We had a pool and tennis courts, and volleyball court, and it was kind of crazy. I figured out we had money. Like, I couldn't quite put the pieces together, but I figured out we had money and more than others, and I think I must have been bragging to somebody about it, another kid.
His father, Abraham, overheard this conversation.
And he pulled me aside and, like, he chewed me out for, like, 30 minutes plus, and he said, "Don't you ever talk or act like that again. Like, you should never think of yourself better than somebody else because you have money or your family has money or your family has this." And he just chewed into me. And, like, it's seared this memory in my head so dramatically that, like, at 44, I can still remember that.
Ajit's parents took this son of New Jersey to India in the summers. And like his father, touring the country with the army, Ajit saw situations that didn't sit well with him. One that stands out years after the fact happened at a train station in Calcutta.
I saw all of these people lying on the floor of the train station who had no other place to live. And they were just homeless, living on the street and around the train station and the floors of the train station. They were half-starved, some were ill, some were just purely destitute with no hope. I mean, it seemed manifest in their faces and their eyes, the despair, and the crushing knowledge that this was all they had and all they could ever hope. I felt a fundamental wrongness with the world, a fundamental wrongness at how we as a people have structured society to allow this to happen, especially with the knowledge that it doesn't have to be this way.
As Ajit was figuring out his own values, his father, Abraham, was working on plans that depended on how his two boys felt about money. When Abraham turned 50 years old, he sold his business to a Fortune 500 company. He went to his sons and asked them how they would feel if their inheritance, instead of going to them, would be used to start a school for children who are the poorest of the poor. Ajit's younger brother was a teenager. Ajit was 22 years old, and being the oldest boy in a traditional Indian family, the person wealth was usually passed on to, his opinion carried a lot of weight.
I certainly had a lot of growing up to still do. But I will say that one place that I think seems consistent from 22 to 44 is I felt it was completely ridiculous that somehow I was born into this lucky family and had all of this wealth and success and opportunities and advantages sort of handed to me on a silver platter, and that would somehow continue on forever. I've always told them, like, I don't need the money. I push them pretty heavily to, like, share and to reinvest that money into the community, into society, into people that, you know, really needed it.
Sorry if this is a really tacky question, but do you know how much you were saying no to, or mm-hmm. how what you were choosing not to receive?
Yeah. I think it was probably, let's see here, probably 25, 30 million. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. For you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Ajit says his brother, his mom, his grandparents, they all supported this plan to use the millions to build a school. Ajit has very strong opinions about passing on large amounts of money to future generations who did nothing to earn it. He says the tradition of inheritance is toxic.
I believe human beings are communal beings. I believe the strength of the community plays into the strength of the individual. Inheritance kind of flies in the face of this because it's not a reinvestment in the community, it's a reinvestment in a very small unit of a family.
Today, Ajit raises money for Ashanti Bhavan, and he spends about 4 months of the year in India helping to run the school. Eventually, he would like to have several Ashanti Bhavans running in India. So far, hundreds of kids have come through the one campus. The oldest graduates are 25 and 26 years old. Some are in college, some are working for companies like Amazon and Goldman Sachs, and others are working for nonprofits. In most cases, these young people are the sole caretaker for their entire family, and they are, in fact, erasing generations of debt. This is what Ajit has hoped for, but he's expecting a lot more.
What will be the trajectory of India or society if you have a half dozen Ashanti Bhavans running simultaneously and putting out these cohorts year after year of kids from the poorest communities, but with shared common values of cooperation and social and civic responsibility and giving back to society?
Ajit is looking forward to seeing Ashanti Bhavan graduates start their own companies and get elected to positions of power. He wonders what will happen if a future prime minister of India is a Ashanti Bhavan graduate. How will they govern when they are raised from the lowest of the low to the highest of the high?
That story came from Sound Effects' Jennifer Wink. This is Sound Effect from KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're talking about stories of money well spent. This next story serves as proof that the Beatles told you a lie. Money can buy you love, or at least one man's idea of love. Paul Currington is a storyteller in Seattle, and he told this tale to a live audience at the storytelling series A Guide to Visitors. Don't worry, it's rated G. And I want to take kind of an unusual step here and say, I just adore this story. Here it is.
A few years ago, a woman I loved very much and had been in a relationship with for a long time broke up with me. And she tried to make it easier on me, but she ended up actually making it worse. She said, "Paul, I'm so sorry. I should have left you years ago." Well, apparently I took that wrong and I went into a big tailspin, and I really handled it wrong. I stopped eating, I stopped sleeping. So then I went completely the opposite way. I just started dating everyone. Any woman who would have me, I would go out with. So of course I dated all the wrong women. I dated the world's angriest yoga teacher. I dated the vegan bisexual sober sex addict. And then I made the big mistake, the classic mistake. I got a crush on an old friend, and she lived out in the forest in a bus. She invited me over for dinner. I go out into the woods. I find her bus, and there are all these little creatures running around. And I pick up one of these little rabbits, little black and white rabbit, and I go, "Oh, I love rabbits. What's his name?" And she goes, "Oh, that's Jack." And I say, "Oh, by the way, what's for dinner?" She said, "Jack." And she took this creature I just formed feelings for, killed him, skinned him, quartered him, put him in a pot right in front of me. So I'm going home that night thinking, you know, I'm just not built for love. It's just not going to happen for me. And for whatever reason, it's not. So I started the tailspin again. I started the depression and the loneliness came up over me. And I didn't know what to do. And then one day, I was watching King 5 News. And they were interviewing this woman from Portland who was a professional cuddler. And I knew immediately, this is what I need. I'd never heard of such a thing, but it was all legit. It was all above board about touch therapy and making people feel loved. And before the interview is even over, I'm online at cuddleuptome.com, and I am booking an appointment. And 2 weeks later, I drive all the way down to Portland, and I find this place, and I get out of the car, I run up to the door, and as soon as I touch the door, I am overwhelmed with embarrassment. Am I really doing this? Am I going to pay someone to hold me? Has it come to this? Yes, it has. It has come to this. This is where we are at. So I walk in, and I see the lady from the interview, Samantha, at the front desk, and she says, "You must be our 3 o'clock. Can I give you a hug?" And I go, "It's on the house, I guess, you know." And she runs over and she gives me this big, full body toddler hug, just like one of those, oh my God. And she's a small woman. I'm like, "Oh, this is quite nice. I don't think I've ever been hugged like this. This is like really full on." And then I hear this voice behind me, "Paul." And I look over and it's Heather, my cuddler. You see, when you book a session, you got to choose your cuddler. And they have 4 cuddlers, and they're all online. And I chose Heather because she had the best bio. They ask all the cuddlers all these different questions. They asked Heather, "What did you always want to be when you grew up?" And Heather said, "A pillow." Yes. Yes. And then they said, "If you could have a superpower, what would it be?" And Heather said, "I wish I had a magical mirror so everyone could see how beautiful they are." This is the person I need. Oh, my God. Yes. And Heather takes me in the back to kind of interview me and explain all the rules. And there are a lot of rules, obviously. There's no touching anywhere where a bathing suit would cover. No hands underneath the clothing, no kissing. You have to understand and accept that nothing is given with sexual intent. All kinds of rules. And I sign my name at the bottom of this thing. And then Heather gives me this little booklet. And I open it up, and she says, "What's your favorite position?" I go, "What?" And I look at this book, and it's all these color photographs of couples in these positions I've never seen in my life. It's just page. It's like the Cuddle Sutra. I'm such an amateur cuddler. I had no idea that this was. My God, I go, "I don't know. I'm a little overwhelmed." And she said, "You know what? Don't worry about it. We'll deal with that later." But then she starts asking me questions. She said, "Paul, why are you here today?" I just think this is where I need to be. She said, "Okay, that's fine." And then she said, "What would you like to get out of your session today?" And I knew what the answer was. And I wanted to say, "Well, you know, all my life, there's this big hole right here in my chest. This big, big hole. I've never been able to fill it. And I've tried everything, and I don't know what to do. And I don't think I can go much longer like this." But you can't say that. So I started babbling again. I said, "You know, I hope I just don't cry in the middle of this. I'm just going to go for that." And she leaned forward, and she took both of my hands. And she said, "Paul, it's going to be okay." And she leads me into this room, and the lights are dim, and there's nice music playing, and there's a little twin bed in the corner. And I laid down on the bed. And Heather laid down next to me. She put her head on my shoulder, and she put her hand on my chest. And for the next hour, it was like a love letter from the universe. It was the closest I've ever come to unconditional love. I had never felt like that before. And all the rules that I thought might get in the way, I was actually grateful for, because I knew I was never going to see Heather outside that room. And so I knew I was never going to fall in love with Heather. And I knew that she was never going to fall in love with me. And most importantly, I was never going to disappoint her. Well, at the end of that hour, I sat up. I had no idea where I was. We had a couple minutes left. She said, "Paul, would you like to play the I love you game?" And I go, "Yeah, I'll play any game you want. I don't know. Whatever you want to do, I'll do." And the I love you game is this. You sit cross-legged on the bed facing each other, and you just say I love you back and forth for 2 minutes. Now, at first, it seemed kind of corny. It seemed silly. Heather said, Paul, I love you. And I said, Heather, I love you. And she said, Paul, I love you. I love you. But after about a minute, it really started to sink in. And by the end, it was really beautiful. It was just, I love you, I love you, I love you. And when I got up and I left the room, I could barely walk. I staggered back to my car and I drove all the way back to Olympia, 2 hours. I didn't turn on the radio. I didn't turn on the phone. I didn't want anything to get between me and that feeling, man. And from then on, every month, I drove down to Portland and had another session with Heather. And every session was better than the last, just what I needed and what I'd been looking for. And that went on for about 6 months until one day my son announced he needed a bunch of dental work and I didn't have enough money for both. I had to choose between caps and cuddles and, you know, I'm thinking, you know, can he chew on the other side of his mouth for a while? How can I, can we? No, but I, of course I chose the kid and he got his dental work and then, but I couldn't go back. I didn't have any money. I knew what I needed and I couldn't get it, man. It was right there. And the months went by, and I got lower and lower, and the loneliness and the depression set in. Until one night, it was a particularly bad night, when I realized I had only one thing left to do. So that night, I walked into my bedroom, and I turned off the lights, and I laid down on my bed, and I closed my eyes. And I put both hands on my chest, and I whispered to myself, I love you, I love you. I love you. Thank you.
Paul Currington runs the storytelling series Fresh Ground Stories in Seattle, and he's a contributor to our show. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Money Well Spent. Next, we have two very different stories about the value of living where we live, in this case, Seattle. The first one considers whether the colossal rent checks that so many of us write are going to the right place. The question is, whose land is this? And do we owe them a bunch of back rent? KNKX's Ariel Van Cleve brings us the story of rethinking our real estate.
A lot of us pay rent, sometimes at an exorbitant rate. But for many of us, it's the price we're willing to pay in order to live in a place with a solid economy and gorgeous views everywhere you look. But long before we got here, the Duwamish tribe called 54,000 acres from Seattle to Bellevue and down to Renton home. They were the original caretakers, or landlords, if you will, of this land. And now that we're living and working in their ancestral land, there's a question of how responsible are we for making past wrongs right. Well, there's an opportunity for you to decide for yourself thanks to an effort to pay the tribe a little back rent. Some folks have already bought into the idea.
Oh, it makes me feel so honored that they know that there is a Duwamish tribe and they in their small way, want to pay rent.
That's Cecile Hansen. She's the chairwoman for the tribe, has been for the last 4 decades. She's a small woman with short gray hair, and as we talk to the tribe's longhouse in Soto, it becomes clear that she's incredibly energetic and blunt. So why exactly is this concept of rent even a thing? 4 words, lack of federal recognition. The Duwamish aren't seen as an official tribe in the eyes of the feds, which means there's no support coming from the government. To understand how that's possible, let's start with a little background. In 1851, the famed Denny Party appeared on the shores of Alki Beach. They were greeted by the Duwamish.
A ship showed up, and that first winter, we helped them survive.
Great. They survive and start making themselves at home, like really at home. Let's fast forward a few years to 1855. This is when the federal government made a deal with the local tribal leaders to exchange land for hunting and fishing rights, a settlement of $150,000, and land to set up reservations. Chief Seattle was the leader of the Duwamish and the first to sign the treaty. There was a problem, though, soon after the agreement was signed. You see, the white settlers who showed up here realized pretty quickly just how valuable this land was. And as the owners of the choicest slice of real estate, the Duwamish weren't allowed to set up a reservation here for themselves.
They signed an initiative that they didn't want to put a reservation over here in Black River.
Now, the Black River, that used to be around Renton and has since dried up. And as far as the they she's referring to, that's Arthur and David Denny, David Swinson Maynard, and Henry Yesler, the fathers of modern-day Seattle, and yes, some of the very same folks who received help from the Duwamish when they first arrived in the area. Hansen says after they blocked the creation of a reservation, many Duwamish were asked to move to other reservations, making it a problem to stay a cohesive tribe.
And that is why we are assimilated all over the place. But we survived, and I keep saying we're still here.
This wasn't a big issue at first, but it became one by the 1960s. And this is where the whole rent-paying reparations would later come in. The federal government made changes to how it recognized tribes. Tribes that stayed on the rolls kept their funding for things like education and health care. Those that were removed lost out. The Duwamish were removed. That's because under these new rules, federal recognition required being a cohesive tribe with a government. That was pretty much impossible for the Duwamish because of this move nearly 100 years before that scattered members across the region. The new rules cost them their fishing rights, too. Gaining back those protections is how Hansen got started in her role as chairwoman in the first place. It was back in the 1970s when she jumped into a battle between her brother and the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
I got involved with my brother who was fishing in the Duwamish River. That was how he'd survived and took care of his family. And the Department of Fisheries, or the people from the state, kept citing him for fishing. He said, "I'm Duwamish."
Hansen started advocating on behalf of her family and the tribe, but kept hearing no. Soon after, she was elected chairwoman. Cue 40 years of activism, still no recognition. That means no fishing rights, no money from the feds to pay for education, health care, upkeep at the tribe's longhouse. Meanwhile, Seattle continues to grow and thrive, while the tribe earns nothing. In the last few years, there's been an effort underway coordinated by a group of volunteers known as the Duwamish Solidarity Group to bring in more money. They created a program called Real Rent Duwamish, where you give a monthly donation. Chandra Farlow is one member of the Solidarity Group. She explained over the phone that the idea came from watching the tribe try and try again to get recognition.
The tribe going through the processes, it's not working. It's not working. So what can the people of Seattle do who aren't Duwamish, who are indigenous to this land, to uplift and amplify the Duwamish tribe's voice?
Now's the time to point out that Farlow is non-native. So she and the roughly 1,900 others who are paying rent to the tribe are essentially putting their money where their mouths are when it comes to finding ways to amplify Duwamish voices. The money goes toward paying the light bill at the longhouse, making sure the roof isn't leaking, paying staff. Some of it goes toward covering the costs of the annual canoe journey. Lots of tangibles that come from giving a little piece of your monthly paycheck. Plus, Farlow says, logically, she understands her actions didn't cause this problem in the first place, the need for the tribe to fight for its rights, but there's a part of her that still feels like she's on the hook for what she calls the legacy of colonial systems.
I still have to remind myself that I, as one person, I didn't create colonial systems, you know, I didn't, but I can be complicit in it and I can be actually building it by my actions daily. So even though I know I'm not responsible as one person for all these things, I am responsible for here and now.
Farlow says this need to understand her role in society, or as she puts it, the here and now, started while she was growing up a military brat living on Air Force bases in different parts of the world. When she landed in Western Washington, she started learning about the Duwamish and other indigenous tribes while studying at Evergreen State College. That's when the desire to right those past wrongs really hit home. But Farlow says she's not motivated by guilt. Instead, she wants to show respect to the people of the Duwamish Nation and the land that their people have lived on since time immemorial. She thinks of it like recognizing we're all tied together, so each of us has to take responsibility.
We're so interconnected. We're so interdependent. upon everything, upon each other, upon the earth cycles, all these things. And it's, to me, it's about acknowledging that actively in action.
And sure, she says her action may be only barely scratching the surface of setting things right after the tribe has struggled for so many years, but it's a start. And that's been totally worth it to her.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today on Sound Effect is Money Well Spent. Seattle writer Paulette Perhatch often finds herself confronted with the question, am I crazy for doing this? What she means is, does it make sense to continue to live in a city where the cost of housing has nearly doubled in the last 6 years or so? As an artist, no less? Well, Paulette is the author of Welcome to the Writer's Life. She's thought a lot about writing as a business and how to make it all work. So it seemed appropriate to do a little cost-benefit analysis of the decision to live out the writer's life in Seattle. We sat down to talk it through. So, Paulette, you're a writer. I assume that means you're wealthy?
Oh, yeah. I flew here.
From Capitol Hill?
On my human drone.
So, give me a sense of what your sort of urban life is like.
I recently moved out of the tiny place I rented in Capitol Hill that was 150 square feet.
Paint us a picture of living in 150 square feet.
You walk into almost a perfect 10-foot cube, which was the den, bedroom, living room, dining room, closet. And then there was kind of a nice little galley kitchen on that place. And then if you want to go to the bathroom, you turn around and go out into the hallway to the tiny closet.
How was that, living in 150 square feet?
You know, it was fine. It was fine.
What are some of the other ways you skimp or behave in a thrifty way to afford to live in an expensive place?
Well, here's the problem. I am a spender. And I'm like, oh, that latte looks good. Oh, that cocktail looks good. So I try to skimp, but my focus has really gone toward not being afraid to try to make more money. I choose to live in the city. This is my strategy for life, is living here because I get so many benefits from it. So I'm going to try to make the income I need to make to live here and still be able to walk into a cafe and get, you know, a drip. Can I get a drip? You know, and really just try to work on my habits of scheduling time to grocery shop and meal plan and cook for myself. I am someone who's bad with money, likes to spend it, and is also trying to live a life where traditionally not a lot of money is made and live in a city that is now one of the world's most expensive cities.
Well, and on that score, how does your lifestyle, particularly the big ticket items like home, car, that kind of thing, how does that stuff compare with people you know or family members from other places?
I actually just got back from a trip to my brother's house, and he's so traditional, you know, and has this like really nice, big, beautiful home. And I'm just like, my life probably looks crazy to you. But I do worry about what it looks like. And I find myself kind of over explaining a lot, like, oh, yeah, you know, writer's life, this is fine.
So how often do you ask yourself this question of like, why am I doing this again? Why am I living in such an expensive place?
When I'm not here. A lot of my friends have moved back to where I went to school in Gainesville, Florida, friends who used to live in Seattle. And when I am in other people's houses and I'm like, oh, this bed does not fold into a couch. That's interesting. That's new and interesting to me.
When you do have that thought, that like that skeptical voice in your head, what are the words that it says to you?
You have been terribly wrong and it's too late to fix it.
Is it possible to be conscientious about money, aware of money, responsible about making and stewarding your money as an artist without it corrupting your creativity?
It is really hard. I think that the biggest tactic that's helped me is to not focus on my art for money. Like when I'm working on essays that I would write no matter what, I don't think about how much is this going to make me at all. I have another plan for making money. If my art makes me money, that's great, but that's not my plan for making money. My plan is to figure out how to make the most out of the least amount of time so that I can buy my time to make my art. And I wish that we valued arts more
One of the most amazing things about art that I learned when researching my book was in Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. He describes how when he was in the Holocaust in a concentration camp, they put on cabarets with art and jokes and little skits. And the more privileged prisoners got to go to those. But the regular prisoners would go, he said, even if it meant missing their meal for the day. And that blew my mind. And I was like, whoa, like art is essential to humans. You can starve for art. And as a society, we act like it's this just like whatever thing. And when you choose to be
like it's frivolous.
And when you choose to be someone who dedicates their life to it, it's so helpful to be around other people who dedicate their life to it.
Is that something that you feel like you are paying for in some way? I mean, are you getting value in exchange for the sacrifices that you're making?
Totally. So there's a few things that are really like have a dollar value, right? So I just got invited to participate in an anthology, to write for an anthology. Is it because I'm the best writer for this anthology? Probably not. But I was the person sitting across from the editor at that moment. And, you know, I say in my book, like, if people don't know you, they can't help you. And then also I have about 4 or 5 published great writers who review my work and comment on it every other week. That would normally maybe cost me, you know, a few $100, but I get it for free because it's my writing group that I have developed through Hugo House. So just being in an artistic community is an education in itself. Seeing what other people are doing, I don't know, it's made all the difference for me.
That's really interesting. So these become not just things that you like, but they become amenities that are part of the reason you're paying a gigantic rent, it seems like.
Totally, yeah.
So when you kind of get down to brass tacks and you go through one of these moments where you really are like, well, how does it weigh? Like, you know, on one side we have the costs and on one side we have the benefits. Where are you coming down on that lately?
I'm coming down on that I think I have what it takes to make enough with the willingness to be like, I'm an entrepreneur and I started a business as a writer and I'm going to make it work for now. I mean, if it gets to, you know, San Francisco levels, then I don't know. But for now, I can make it work. There's so many ways that I see, like in this book, Creativity by Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. You know, he talks about these centers of creativity and how that really makes a difference. You know, he said actually that it, in the arts as well as some other areas, in science and business, that location matters as much as buying real estate, you know. And I've seen what it's done for me over the last 8 years. And I think that I can become the best version of myself in a place like Seattle. A version of myself that I wouldn't be able to come if I didn't live here. So, you know, for now, I'm doing it and it's a lot of work, but if I feel alive and happy, and that is really the most that I want out of life.
Paulette Perhatch is a writer in Seattle. We'll link to her book, Welcome to the Writer's Life, and much more of her work at knkxsoundeffect.org. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestedt, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. We had help this week from Ariel Van Cleve and from Paul Currington. Special thanks to the producers of A Guide to Visitors, Jeannie Yandel, Phyllis Fletcher, Wolf Maycutt, and Rebecca Grossman. Tune in next week when our theme is Daddy Issues. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.